are Hal Higgard and Aldo Riello, and they're going to speak about SL2 Seacher and Simon theory and spin foam gravity with a cosmological constant.
Thank you, Jorge. This is working collaboration with Mushin Han and Wojciech Kaminski. And actually, the motivation for this talk, well, everybody can hear me?
Yes.
Yes, you do. Light up here.
Okay. So, motivation for this work is for sure that the cosmological constant there has been measured. And in fact, we have also the belief that it should be incorporated at the very fundamental level in our models. This is not a new idea and has been already out there since at least 20 years. And the prototype example of this for spin foams is the Ture-Viro model. The Ture-Viro model is obtained by q-deforming the Ponsano-Radje ansatz for 3D gravity. And in fact, the main results of this deformation are, on one side, the fact that it becomes mathematically well-defined, and on the other one is that one obtains a model for 3D gravity with cosmological constant. On these lines, attempts have been already put forward to deform 4D four-dimensional models, spin foam models for quantum gravity, in order to obtain models with the cosmological constant. And in fact, this was quite somehow an ad hoc procedure, and was really inspired by the three-dimensional case. Here, what we want to do is to give a more constructive route towards something like this, and to check if the quantum group structure is really surviving this constructive route. What we're led to consider is a coupling of the LQG spin foam models to Chern-Simon theory in a specific way that I will describe in detail in the rest of the talk. And in fact, this happens in a way which is pretty much consistent, even if quite different on the conceptual level, with previous work on the Hamiltonian side and the Kodama state. So what we gain by not attacking the problem directly from the quantum group perspective is in particular a more geometric language with connections and holonomies instead of a purely algebraic one, which simplifies the reconstruction theorem. So what do we gain, and here I'm on slide 2, what do we gain by coupling to Chern-Simons? First of all, we for sure enlarge the usual framework, and this allows us to use many of the tools that were developed in the last 25 years for Chern-Simon theory into spin foams. And what we did for the moment is just scratching the surface of all these immense possibilities that are open to us. Then, by studying the asymptotic regime and the equations of motion of this model, we developed a new description of curved symplices in 3 and 4 dimensions, and the main novelty is that holonomies not only encode parallel transfers from one chunk of space to the next one, but also what is usually encoded into fluxes, that is, area elements, which now are intrinsically curved. Another important result of the construction is that we obtain a model which describes at the same time spherically and hyperbolically curved geometries. That is, the cosmological sign can have both signs, and this sign is determined only semi-classically and dynamically, basically by the boundary states we're putting around our spin foam. We also find that the cosmological constant should be quantized, and this happens in the right direction. That is, should be that the cosmological horizon should be constituted by many Planck units, and in a discrete set of Planck units. So the main results are described on slide 3. And they come from the asymptotics. First of all, I want to warn that everything we did for the moment just concerned a single force simplex, and we have ideas on how to go beyond this situation, but There are still many details to be fixed, and I don't want to speak about that in this talk. So the equations of motion of the model we are going to describe actually allow to reconstruct a fully curved for simplex with positive or negative curvature. By fully curved, I mean a for simplex that is not just living in a curved spacetime, but can really wrap around the whole of the spacetime, can have the size a size that is comparable to the radius of curvature. The Rajah action that we obtain, well, in studying the asymptotics and using the reconstruction results, we're able also to show that the amplitude, well, the oscillating part of the amplitude at leading order reproduces the Rajah action for a curve for simplex augmented by the cosmological term. And here you see the formula, it's the usual Rajah action, except that here areas and dihedral angles are calculated on the curve for simplex, and then there is the cosmological term where the four volume is the curve for simplex volume. We actually find some other extra terms which need to be still fully understood. We know something about them, that is that they are parity invariant and therefore can be somehow isolated by the Rajah part of the action. But still, there are many things we don't understand, what they mean geometrically and so on. And this is work in progress. On slide 4, you have the plan of the talk. In the first part, I will describe how we come out with this model, with this what we call the lambda EPRL model, which is this deformation of EPRL. Then I will describe how to obtain the equations of motion for this deformed model, which are reminiscent but different from those in the flat case. And then Hal will go on explaining you how it works in the 3D case, that is how you can reconstruct the boundary 3D geometry out of the equations of motion. The 4D case will be left for another talk because it's analogous but like more complicated and probably it's not worth going into the details here. In the end, he will also explain how this result about the 3D geometry can be used to go towards the deform spin networks and a deformed phase space for curved geometries. So let me start the main part of the talk on slide 5. Here we briefly summarize the philosophy behind the EPRL model, which is pretty much the philosophy behind Rajah gravity. That is, what we want to do is to describe a four-dimensional manifold by triangulating it with flat building blocks with curvature defects on triangles. So how this is obtained at the quantum level? This is obtained by implementing flatness in the bulk of the building blocks of the four simplices via BF dynamic. And then we implement the defect by just summing over a subset of all the possible BF boundary states around every four simplex, which are those that admit the geometrical interpretation. This breaks the topological character of BF theory and hopefully gives us the gravity back in some continuous limit. So this is pretty much in the philosophy of the Palatini formulation of gravity, where general relativity is expressed as BF theory with plus geometricity constraints. So the mathematics of this is spelled out on slide 6, where I express the EPRL amplitude for a boundary 3D spin network state, psi of gamma, where gamma is in fact the graph dual to the boundary of a four simplex. It's the usual pentagon graph. Here I just drew the 1-1, the three-dimensional analog, the d minus one dimensional analog of this in the picture. So it's living on the boundary of the four simplex, which is a three sphere. And the way I write this amplitude is as follows. One takes the 3D spin network state, embeds it in spacetime via this F gamma map, which is the usually EPRL map. And now this spin network state is a projective spin network, which is a functional of SL2C holonomies that here are represented with the letter G, and they're holonomies of the connection curly A, which is a connection in SL2C. this observable is then weighted by ABF action, which where B is the bivector field, which on the geometric state is morally the same as the E wedge E field. And you see that this field can be integrated over because it's a Lagrange multiplier for the curvature, and therefore these integrations give simply a delta of the curvature, which then can be implemented at the level of the ball as just evaluating it onto the identity, on the trivial holonomies. So this formulation of Ipiral is maybe not the most common one, but it's completely equivalent to the ones that you prefer and know very well. So on slide 7, I simply try to generalize this philosophy to the curved case, where we replace the flat simplices with homogeneously curved ones. The curvature is then implemented in the same way via defects, but now instead of having BF dynamics implementing flatness, I want to use lambda BF, what they call lambda BF dynamics, which is BF minus lambda BB action. And you see that this is implementing homogeneous curvature, because if you look at the equation of motion for this action, for this Lagrangian, you find that F equals lambda B, and B now is morally given by E wedge G, and therefore the space that this is describing should be an homogeneous space. So on slide 8, you simply find the same mass as before, except that now is this lambda BF action which is used. Again, the integration over the B field can be performed because it's a Gaussian integration, and it gives you an effective action for the connection A, for a second order action, which is given by the second Chern form, which is F wedge F. And in fact, this form is interestingly an exact differential, and therefore can be pushed to the boundary of the fourth simplex. In fact, all the objects appearing in this path integral just live on the boundary, except for of the fourth simplex, except for the connection, which is also defined in the bulk. But now we can, since this F wedge F Lagrangian is an exact differential of the Chern-Simons form, we can push it also to the boundary and obtain this expression, which basically is the Chern-Simons evaluation of the Ipiral Ipiral graph operator. So this is very nice, but there is still one missing detail, that is the Ipiral model is constructing out of the host deformation of the Einstein-Hilbert action, and therefore we want to implement it also at the level of the Chern-Simon functional to be fully consistent on one side, and we see that this is necessary once you write the equations of motion, which otherwise wouldn't really give all the results that we're going to describe later on. So on slide 9, I do exactly this, and you see that as it is natural, we are kind of forced to decompose the SL2C connection into its self-dual and anti-self-dual part. This is because in the host deformation, there is the odd operator appearing, and therefore one is naturally led to consider these two copies of Chern-Simon theory. The Chern-Simons level becomes now complex and is this H, and you see that the I is really what the leftover of the odd operator in this formalism. H bar is simply the complex conjugate of H, and in this way the total action is in fact real. The full amplitude doesn't completely factorize in a self-dual and anti-self-dual part, because the Ipiral observable here is not an holomorphic functional of the self-dual connection, and therefore contains both the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of it. So we see that in this expression only quantities on the boundaries are used, and in the end we are left with the Chern-Simons evaluation of a very particular Wilson graph operator. So this is a natural generalization of the usual not observable for Chern-Simon theory to graph observables, in fact. So on slide 10, I discussed two immediate consequences of this formulation. And the first one is that the Chern-Simons level being complex, there is no known quantum group structure associated to the graph evaluation. This would, we would have a quantum group, a known quantum group structure at least, in the case H was purely imaginary, and I will come back on this in a second. But before, I want to point out also that for the theory, for the model to be invariant under large gauge transformations, one needs that the real part of the Chern-Simons level H is an integer, and this immediately translates into this quantization of the cosmological horizon in Planck units. And you see also that the Barberio-Mirsky parameter appears where you expect to appear, that is in front of the Planck length square. On slide 11, I come back to the three, I want to discuss three interesting limits of this theory. The first one is obviously the one in which lambda goes to zero, and we hope to recover the flat T-Purel model, and this is morally happening because sending lambda to zero means sending the Chern-Simons level to infinity, which is like sending h-bar to zero in the end, and therefore this is projecting Chern-Simons onto its classical solutions, which are flat, and we therefore obtain the same result that we would have obtained if we were using BF theory. This also happens in a more precise sense at the level of the equations of motion. Then I was telling you that there is one can regain a quantum group description of the graph evaluation once the Chern-Simons level is purely imaginary. This is obtained in the limit in which the Barberio-Mirsky parameter goes to infinity. And in fact, what is interesting is that the Purel graph operator in this same limit goes morally into the Barrett-Crane's graph operator. And the Q-deform model of Barrett-Crane has already been studied, so it would be interesting to see if there is something more precise that can be said about that. In just a curiosity is that the Q parameter that one obtains by looking at our model is exactly what was proposed by Karim Nui and Philip Roche in their paper. In the end, the last limit that one is interested about and is actually the subject of our work is the limit in which we recover discrete classical geometries, which is what I call lambda Rajah limit. So on slide 12, you find how to obtain this limit, and it's actually exactly the same thing as in standard spin foams, that is we send the Planck length to zero, and at the same time we have to rescale the SU2 representation labels to infinity in such a way to have finite size discrete geometries as a result. So sending the Planck length to zero means again sending H, the Chern-Simons level, to infinity, and this corresponds to flat solution of the Chern-Simons theory. But contrary to the previous limit, here we are also rescaling the graph operator. And this has the result of letting the graph operator act as a distributional source for the Chern-Simons connection, therefore avoiding global flatness. In this way, it's easy to realize that the semi-classical limit should correspond to the study of flat connection on the graph complement. That is, we take the ambient space in which the Chern-Simons theory is defined, that is the free sphere, and outside of the graph, the connection should be flat. So on slide 13, I try to describe a little bit how the graph complement look like in this case. So the gamma graph, as I was telling you, is the dual to the boundary of a four simplex, and this pentagon graph. And taking its graph complement means fattening a little bit this graph and removing the interior of this fattened graph outside of the three sphere. So what you have to imagine is that here, in fact, the whole R3 is representing S3 once you compactify it at infinity. And So you have to imagine that this Fatten graph is hollow, is empty on the inside, and the space you are considering is the whole R3 surrounding it. So the, what you obtain is a three-dimensional manifold whose boundaries is a genus 6 surface, and this number 6 will come up in a couple of slides. What is important now is to define, well, first of all, to describe holonomies in the graph complement, what you need to study are holonomies, are a specific, well, are a basis of the holonomies on the graph complement. In fact, since, because of the flatness, every contract loop which is contractible can, it gives trivial holonomies, and therefore it is enough to study a finite set of these holonomies to completely understand and characterize the flat solutions on the graph complement. So on slide 14, I define which holonomies are we looking at, and in fact we need to be very precise on which path these holonomies are defined. So there are two classes of holonomies: the transverse, those transverse to the graph we wind around the tubes, and those longitudinal to the tubes of the Fatten graph. So for what concerns the transverse ones, here you have a picture of what happens at the vertex of the graph, and you see that we have to choose a base point at the vertex, and then we go a little bit towards the tube, wind around the tube, and come back to the base point. The winding is done via a right-handed rule for all of them. For what concerns the longitudinal holonomies, this is slightly more tricky because the structure of the graph is quite complicated, and we have to pay attention that the path defining these holonomies don't wind around the tubes. There is no canonical way to do this, so the standard way to do that is to take the gamma 5 graph and basically project it onto a plane, and once you do this, you have automatically a preferred choice of path. That is, you can draw them on the top, somehow on the top of the tubes as seen from above once you projected the graph on the plane. This is called the blackboard framing because it's using this 2D projection on the graph. So now that we have defined the path along which all the holonomies are defined, we can study the equations that describe them. Well, that these holonomies should satisfy. So you see on slide 15 that around every vertex of the graph there is a particular composition, well, the natural counterclockwise composition of the holonomies gives a contractible loop which can be undone from around the vertex, and this gives what we call a closure constraint, which is the product of the holonomies in a particular order should give the trivial holonomy. In fact, there is an extra ingredient which is not written on the slide but is very important for the model to work, is that these H holonomies, when calculated very close to a vertex, are all contained in the same SU2 subgroup of SL2C. And this is a property of the EPIRAL spin network functional. And this is analogous to what happens in the flat case, where close to a vertex we recover SU2 intertwiners. So then we have what we call the parallel transport equation, and we can obtain them by looking what happens along the tube. So we take a transverse holonomy at one end of it, compose it with the longitudinal holonomies, then with another transverse holonomy at the other end of the tube, and come back to the original vertex. Doing this gives another contractible path, which should therefore correspond to trivial holonomies. This can be rewritten in this suggestive way, where you see that the transverse holonomy H at vertex A along in direction of the vertex B is parallel transported by the G into the into the corresponding transverse ulnomy at the other end of the tube. The minus one that you see in the formula is basically taking care of preserving orientations. Finally, there is a last set of equations, which is this, very important for the four-dimensional geometry, and these are concerning the longitudinal ulnomies. So remember that I told you that the boundary of the graph complement manifold is a six-genus surface, and therefore there are six independent cycles around it, which are, so here I drew two of them. One goes from vertex one, then to vertex two, then to vertex five and back, and the other one is going around vertices two, three, and four. So five out of six of such cycles are contractible, and an example is the green one here in the picture. And therefore, well, in fact, they are contractible on the graph complement. And recall that this manifold is represented by the R3 surrounding the tubes. So, so five out of six of these cycles have must be trivial, but the last one, depicted in orange, is non-trivial, and this is because it's winding around the 1-3 tube. This is very important because if all the cycles were trivial, then this would mean that the G's, the longitudinal ulnomies, could be factorized into two ulnomies depending only on the vertex, on one vertex of the graph. And this would correspond to a flat geometry. So if a big G is equal to a small g times another small g to the minus one, these small g's can be interpreted as the ulnomies going from the vertex to the center of the four simplex. And this is exactly what happens in the flat case. Since this is not possible, it's the sign that there is some curvature in the bulk of the four simplex. So now Hal will describe what happens at the level of the 3D geometries, and in particular, he will focus on the first of these equations. Thank you. Hello? Really?
Can you hear me?
For real?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, good.
Yes, we do.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here. Sorry for the technical glitch. Let's go on to slide 16. So Aldo has given you an overview of the construction of the model and the resulting equations of motion. And I'd like to change pace a little and give you a very concrete, constructive view of how the geometry comes out of these equations of motion. So we've been able to reconstruct the full 4D geometry of the four simplex, but the construction is somewhat involved, and in fact, we understood it for the first time in the three-dimensional context. So I'd like to take you through that and point out some of the analogies with the 4D case. So for definiteness, let me focus on the spherical case. In fact, all of the constructions we'll talk about go through in both the spherical and the hyperbolic case, but I'll return to that point later in the talk. So there are two main ingredients that we need. Just as we build the fluxes in the flat case out of a normal to the face of a tetrahedron, and the magnitude of the flux vector is equal to the area of the face, I need to tell you how to think about the normals and the areas of these curved tetrahedra. So on the next slide, I introduce a curved tetrahedron. This is slide 17. And in particular, a spherical tetrahedron is given by four points in S3 connected by geodesics. It's useful to think of these four points as being in R4, so you embed the S3 in R4. And if I pick two of the vertices, I can think of these as two vectors in R4. Those two vectors span a two-plane in the R4. And you can intersect this two-plane with the three-sphere, and you find an equatorial great circle. And the edge of the spherical tetrahedron is just a segment of this great circle. So I mention this because it's a useful way to think also about the faces of the spherical tetrahedron. A face is determined by three of the vertices. Again, these three vertices determine three vectors in R4. Those three vectors span a three-dimensional hyperplane in the R4. If we intersect that hyperplane with the three-sphere, we get a great two-sphere. And the face of the spherical tetrahedron is a portion of this great two-sphere. The importance of this sort of elementary geometry is that great spheres are flatly embedded in S3. That is, they have no extrinsic curvature. So again, an analogy is useful. If you think of a plane in R3, the plane is flatly embedded. If you take a normal to the plane and you parallel transport it around the plane, you always get another normal to the plane. In the same way, if you take a normal to the face of a spherical tetrahedron, because the face is a great two-sphere, a segment of a great two-sphere, when you parallel transport that normal vector to another point of the face, you again get a normal vector to the face. So this means that the normal of a face is well-defined even in the spherical context. So that's the first ingredient that we need to build a generalization of the flux vectors. On the next slide, I'd like to convince you that the holonomy around a curved triangle is equal to the area of the triangle. So I'll give an elementary argument for this, and the significance of this argument is that its simplicity really makes this connection compelling, I think. So I begin with the vertex at the top of the triangle and choose a tangent vector to the left edge. The parallel transport of this is illustrated on the next slide, and of course, because I chose a tangent vector because it transports simply. On the next slide, we pick up a second tangent vector now to the bottom edge, and you can see that the angle between the green and the purple tangent vectors is beta bar. It's the complement of the angle beta in the spherical triangle. The utility of having these two vectors now is that we know the angle between them will be preserved under parallel transport, and we can carry them both over to the vertex on the right and repeat the process. So now we pick up the orange tangent vector and the angle complement to gamma. And then finally, on the next slide, I've carried all three of those vectors up to the original vertex, and you see what the holonomy is. It's the rotation of the green vector in a counterclockwise sense about the normal to the triangle by an angle of 2 pi minus the sum of these angle complements. But a one-line calculation shows you immediately that this is the spherical excess, namely the area of a spherical triangle. So on slide 19, we can put these two ingredients together, and we see that we can sort of generalize the flux variables to these transverse holonomies that Aldo was discussing. And in particular, we can think of this holonomy as having an angle equal to the area of the face and an axis, which is the normal vector to the face. The nice thing about putting these transverse holonomies in this form is that a natural idea arises for describing the full geometry of the curved tetrahedron. Namely, it should be captured by the homotopic triviality of these four face holonomies. The ordered product of the holonomies has to be the identity. So one immediate motivation for believing that this would be the case is to take the large radius of curvature limit. In this limit, the lowest order term becomes exactly the closure of the flat tetrahedron, namely the product of the areas with the normals to the faces of flat tetrahedron, and we recover a flat Minkowski theorem, a correspondence between this closure and a flat tetrahedron. That theorem's been known for some time, and here we'd like to generalize this to the curved context by claiming that there's a correspondence between a curved tetrahedron and a product of holonomies around its faces. You'll notice here that I've transitioned to working with SO3 rather than SU2. This is just because the construction goes slightly more simply in the SO3 context. At the end of the construction, I'll mention how we lift these SO3 group elements up into SU2, and that brings us back to the equation of motion, the closure equation of motion that Aldo discussed on slide 15. So the in particular, let me point out one piece of notation that's useful also. We label the faces of the tetrahedron by the opposite vertices. So you can see that in the figure here. Okay, so hopefully I've convinced you that one direction of this correspondence is simple. If we are given a spherical tetrahedron, we can simply compute the holonomy around its faces, and indeed they'll satisfy this closure condition. Now I'd like to convince you of the other direction of this theorem.
Question?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. In the beginning, you were evaluating a path integral for a quantum theory with a complex SL2C connection. And now we're understanding a classical problem for SU2. Is this classical problem for SU2 related to the critical point for the complex path integral?
Yes, that's exactly right. So Aldo mentioned very briefly that near the vertex of the gamma 5 graph, the SL2C group elements become SU2 group elements. And here we're understanding exactly as you said, the stationary phase conditions, which are these equations of motion, and how they connect with the curve geometry.
Okay, I'll come back in the question section to ask about how much this shows about the complex path integral, but go on for now.
Okay. So on the next slide, let me pick up this question of how do we, given these four group elements that close to the identity, how do we reconstruct a geometry from them? So we access the global geometry by thinking about a set of what we call simple paths. So let's construct a topological tetrahedron, just four points, four ordered points, and specify the holonomies by choosing paths between these four points. So these are the four paths illustrated in the figures here. And you'll notice that not all of these paths are on an equal footing. The last face has this extra path along the 4-2 edge. So this picks out a special edge of the tetrahedron. So this particular choice of path seems somewhat arbitrary, but a nice surprise is that from the 4D perspective, it's not arbitrary. This is a somewhat involved argument, so let me just give you a sense of the flavor of the argument, and you can ask for more details if you like. Requiring that the faces, so usually we just think about the gamma 5 graph, but if we also require that its faces, here I've shaded one in green, intersect only along its edges, and using the blackboard framing that Aldo mentioned earlier, you actually can completely specify this choice of paths at each of the vertices. Okay, so we have a choice of paths, and how does this actually give us a spherical geometry? This is explained on the next slide, slide 21. So what these choice of paths does is it gives us a way to interpret the Gram matrix of the spherical geometry. So this is rather immediate for many of the dihedral angles of the spherical geometry. If I consider vectors n1 and n3, normal to faces 1 and 3, those faces both contain the vertex 4. And so if I base these vectors at vertex 4, well, then their dot product is already geometrically meaningful, and I can use it as an entry in a Gram matrix. The only entry of the Gram matrix that is unclear is the one between normals 2 and 4. This is because normal 4 has this extra transport along this special edge 2, 4. But we can extract the geometrically meaningful dot product just by considering this parallel transport. So if I look at normals 2 and 4, these are the orange normals in the right panel. I could initially base them at vertex 3. And then I could carry normal 2, that's the back normal, up along the edge 3, 4 to base it at 4. Meanwhile, I could follow the path and carry N4 up along edges 3, 2, and 2, 4 to base it at 0.4. And you notice that if I take that edge holonomy, the one on N2 from 3 to 4, and move it over to the 4 vector, I actually get the full face holonomy of face 1. So the rotation that I need to perform on N4 is just the holonomy O1 acting on N4. And then the dot product between these two vectors becomes geometrically meaningful, and I can fill in all of the entries of the Gram matrix. So this gives me what I'll call a curved Gram matrix. And there's a nice theorem, elementary theorem in curved geometry, that given a Gram matrix of a tetrahedron, you uniquely specify the tetrahedron. So if we can compute these Gram matrix entries, we can actually uniquely specify a curved tetrahedron. And this is easy now. Here the notation at the bottom of the slide is that the group elements are denoted in normal face, and the bold face is the matrix representation. I can extract the dot products from that exponential form just by taking traces. And in particular, there's a kind of nice analogy here. These look like connected two-point functions. So this allows us to calculate the dot products and fill in the entries of this Gram matrix. So before proceeding with the general discussion, let me make one more connection to the four-dimensional context. So here we notice that there was this special edge, edge 2-4. If we go back to slide 20, we can actually see that a similar thing is occurring in this projection of the gamma 5 graph. In the bottom right of this panel, we see that two of the edges of the gamma 5 graph cross. And this wasn't an arbitrary drawing. There's no way to project this into a plane without two of them crossing. And this crossing captures exactly that information for the four simplex also. It tells you what the special edge, quote unquote, of the four simplex is. And so we can proceed in a similar way for the four simplex. Okay. Let's continue
on. Can you explain again why H24 is special from the 4D point of view compared to H14 or 3-4? What's so special about 2 versus 1 or 3? It's not clear. You have this rotation symmetry anyway.
Yes, I understand. It's a detailed explanation for why. But notice that there's no way that we could have based all the normals of the curved tetrahedron at any one of the vertices without picking out a special edge. So why that particular special edge? What I'm telling you is that it comes from the geometry of the gamma 5 graph and its faces. And I'm just going to leave it at that for now, but we can discuss it more if you like.
Again, the question is, why do I need transport for 2-4, but I don't need transport for 1-4? They don't seem, 1 and 4 don't seem to be based at the same point, or maybe I'm missing something in your explanation. Can you explain why 1 and 4 are based at the same point? It's clear that 1, 2, 3 are based at the same point, but... Do you see the question? It's clear that 1, 2, 3 are based at the same point, but I don't see why 1 and 3, 1 and 4, 2 and 4, and 3 and 4 are based at the same point.
Yes, I understand the question. So for 1 and 4... It's true that they're not both based at the same point, but they share a vertex, right? The two paths share a vertex, and so it's just a matter of transporting that shared dot product up to the vertex 4. Is that clear?
Not completely. They always, I don't know. Don't they always share a vertex?
Laurent, can I find the scalar product at vertex 2, where there is no problem, and then you parallel transport both up to vertex 4? And, well, it takes a little bit to convince oneself that this doesn't introduce any further rotation, but because at 2, the normal to the face, what is it, 1, is parallel transported along its own face, so nothing happens, while for what concerns vertex 4, in the normal to the phase 4, it's parallel transported towards the edge, towards vertex 4, along the edge, well, the usual edge by which it's parallel transported up. So you get the N4 appearing in the closure in this way. It's a bit tricky, but it's simple.
Maybe can you show that at the end of the day, this Gram matrix doesn't depend on the choice of vertex and edge you have? That would be, is that obvious from the construction?
In a sense, it does.
That would show that this Gram matrix is independent on, that's your claim, right? That this object is completely independent on this extra data.
No, the claim is not that it's independent of that extra data. It matters that we chose that special edge. We would reconstruct a different tetrahedron if we chose a different special edge. There are gauge transformations to some other choices of special edge, but it's not completely independent of that. That's why I'm saying it's important that the special path comes down from the 4 geometry.
Sorry, the Gram matrix has to be gauge independent. It doesn't matter. The Gram matrix is completely symmetric. It has the symmetry of the tetrahedra.
Yes, I agree with that. But the specification of this Gram matrix using the holonomies is not completely independent of the choice of path that I use to specify them.
So the question is that could you check at the end that it has tetrahedral symmetry?
It does, yes. Okay, so let's move on to slide 22. One piece of the story that I haven't told you yet is what determines the sign of the curvature. I've been working in the fixed sign of a positive spherical geometry, but a nice factor of this construction is that the Gram matrix also determines the sign of the curvature. So it does this through the determinant of the Gram matrix. The geometry is spherical if this determinant is positive and hyperbolic if it's negative. So let me give you a brief insight into how this works. If we consider a flat Euclidean tetrahedron, its four normal vectors are certainly linearly dependent because there are four vectors in an R3. And so the determinant of this Gram matrix is identically zero. And then continuity in the curvature parameter motivates the claim that the spherical and hyperbolic cases are separated by this Euclidean case. So there's sort of two nice consequences of this observation. The first one is the one that Aldo mentioned in the introduction, which is that the sign of the cosmological constant is determined here by the boundary data of our spherical, of our spin networks. So the tetrahedral data on the boundary determine the sign of the cosmological constant. A second interesting observation here is that there's no need for a second group. We're always working with SU2 or SO3, and this determines both the spherical and the hyperbolic cases. In the next slide, I introduce the last complication, which is, as mentioned, there's a spin lift that connects these SO3 group elements with the SU2 group elements. So this is done in a homological style argument. So we decorate the edges of the tetrahedron with extra plus and minus signs. And whether an SO3 element gets lifted to an element that's connected to the identity or to minus the identity is determined by the product of these signs as you go along the edges. So in summary, the result is a full constructive proof of the Minkowski theorem for curved tetrahedra. And this is very interesting, partly because it leads to a natural conjecture. In the flat case, we know that Minkowski proved that any polyhedron with n faces corresponds to a closure relation of n SU2 Lie algebra elements. And so we conjecture that a closure of n SU2 group elements corresponds to a constant curvature polyhedron. We have not proved this. This is simply a conjecture, but it's motivated by this work on tetrahedra. So up to this point, I've focused here on three-dimensional constructions. The same sorts of techniques work in the reconstruction of the four-simplex. In particular, now the longitudinal holonomies come into the picture. They tell us how to assemble the various tetrahedra at the vertices into the full four-simplex. In fact, much like in the holonomy flux algebra, you have that the holonomies and the fluxes are in a certain sense canonically conjugate. The H's and G's are also in a certain sense canonically conjugate. To make that more precise, they're like the Fenchel-Nielsen coordinates of a Teich-Muller space. You wouldn't expect them to really have Poisson bracket 1 because the holonomy flux algebra doesn't have that property either. So it's a more nuanced sense of phase-space variable. So rather than getting into more technicalities around these structures, let me again turn to 3D and explore the simplest possible aspect of this phase space. We know that the fluxes act as a phase space variables for certain reduced phase spaces of polyhedra. So let's explore that connection here in the curved context also. So this is slide 24. Our transverse holonomies, the H's that we've been talking about, determine a curved phase space structure. Each holonomy acts a bit like a curved vector. What I mean is that if you consider that holonomy is generating a geodesic segment from the identity out to the group element, then you have this sort of arc, this geodesic arc that you can think of as being related to the group element. Here we see that SU2 is actually playing a nice role, and it's partly why we perform this spin lift. The area of the spherical triangle gets divided by 2 when you parameterize it in terms of an SU2 variable. And this means that these geodesic arcs never are longer than the antipodal points. And so this keeps the phase space well defined. You never stretch beyond 2 antipodal points in S3. Which is the group manifold of SU2. So it also, much like the flux case, where a flux of a fixed magnitude, when acted on by the full rotation group, sweeps out a two-sphere in the angular momentum space, here these transverse holonomies, when acted on by conjugation, sweep out a two-sphere in this SU2 group manifold. And this two-sphere is symplectic. In fact, it's exactly the dressing, the orbit of the dressing action of this of a quasi-Poisson-Lie group. So what I'm trying to tell you is that all of the classical ingredients needed for a Q deformation are appearing in a very natural way here. And this is wonderful because we can start to use symplectic tools in the context of studying curved geometries. So I continue that on slide 25. Much like in the case of a flat tetrahedron where you consider the closure as giving rise to a polygon, a linkage in R3, the four vectors summing up to 0, here we have the four geodesic arcs connecting up to give us the identity and return us to give us a curved linkage. And we can associate a reduced phase space with this linkage. It's every point of this reduced phase space corresponds to a curved tetrahedron with fixed face areas, where the face areas are equal to the length of the linkage on the left. And the coordinates of the reduced phase space, which describes all possible such tetrahedra, are the diagonal length of the linkage here, H2, H1, and the bending angle around this diagonal. These are the azimuthal and z coordinates of the two-sphere on the right. So much like in the flat case, distinct polyhedra correspond to distinct intertwiners for the quantum theory with a cosmological constant, and these correspond to spherical polygons. So much as Eugenio Bianchi and I did in the flat case, you can apply Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization to this context. And just because the phase space is compact, you immediately see that curved tetrahedra have discrete volume spectrum. So that's just a brief look at the phase-space structure. There's much more to say here, but let me now conclude on slide 26. We hope to have convinced you that SL2C Schoen-Simons theory is a interesting tool for substituting BF theory with lambda BF theory, and that this leads to the quantization of the cosmological constant. Moreover, it leads to a very nice construction of curved geometries that results from the equations of motion. And the phase space of these geometries is quantized and leads to quantized observables such as the volume of the tetrahedra. And finally, by connecting Schoen-Simons theory with the cosmological constant in 4D, we hope to have clarified a bit how the quantum groups come out in the study of the cosmological constant. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Hi, this is John. If you go back to the slide, I think it was 9 or 10, this is where you modified the action to incorporate the Barbaro-Mertzi parameter. I probably should have said something much earlier. So I'm a little bit confused why it's necessary to change the action in order to incorporate the Barbaro-Mertzi parameter, because I thought it was already included in the map F-gamma, because the map F-gamma is really telling you what the relationship is between basically the Plobansky 2 form, the star E-wedge E variable, and the variable conjugate to A. So it seems that even before you modify the action, you already get the right, the host action with the cosmological constant term. So is it really necessary to change the action like that?
So this is a good question. In fact, at the beginning, we were looking at the action on slide 8, not really that one on slide 9. And the problem with that is that we were getting equations of motion which were not really as nice as the ones that we get with this new action. And so this is one reason. In particular, since there is an interplay between the graph, which acts as a source for the curvature, and the connection, once you calculate the transversal anomies and you want them to be in SU2 close to a vertex in order to allow this nice geometrical interpretation, you need a prefactor close to the curvature to cancel the I gamma terms appearing naturally out of the ethereal functional. So this is one possible answer. Another possible answer is that the same action with this particular weight can be found by studying the Hamiltonian, well, somehow e to the I, this new action solves formally the Hamiltonian constraint for loop quantum gravity with real Barbaro-Mertzi parameter. And somehow these reasons are kind of related. So these two way of looking at the problem are kind of related, because what you really want is that your tetrahedra somehow solve the Hamiltonian constraint. That is, they are flat embedded, so the extrinsic curvature vanishes, which means that they are actually in SU2. So the anomalies describing their faces are in SU2. So all these things I wouldn't say that I have a super rigorous mathematical proof that they are all related, but they kind of go all in the same directions. Does it answer your question?
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Question?
Go ahead.
I don't know if this is a technical question or an important question, but in past work in the 90s, we didn't consider your first line there and then go to the Schoen-Simons theory on the boundary as an equivalent expression. We instead added the Schoen-Simons theory on the boundary so that the four-dimensional path interval would have a well-defined critical point. So rather than integrating out the bulk part of the action and leaving just the Chern-Simon theory on the three-dimensional boundary, we had, if you like, the sum of the Chern-Simon theory and the three-dimensional boundary with the four-dimensional DF action deformed by lambda. Does that make a difference to your construction?
Can you repeat the question, please?
If you take the first line of your action on slide 8, you just take the first line, it doesn't have a well-defined critical point. To make it have a well-defined critical point, you add the Chern-Simon action on the three-dimensional boundary, and then the whole action, which is the sum of the four-dimensional DF action and the three-dimensional Chern-Simon action on the boundary, has a well-defined critical point. And that's the way I would understand the introduction of Chern-Simon theory into the four-dimensional spin-formal DF action.
So, but is it a comment or a question?
If you just added the Chern-Simons action to the first line, and so it has a combination of the BF in the bulk and the Chern-Simon on the boundary, I don't think it would change anything in your study of the critical points, but I think it would be more correct.
Okay. Possibly. It would...
Otherwise, the whole four-dimensional...
The derivation is very sketchy. It's not meant to be a first principle, mathematically rigorous derivation. And so I think that there are subtleties about having a reference connection in the bulk and things like this. So there should be some extra terms which are a priori constant and conventional, and maybe one can cancel them by your procedure. That's possible. I didn't look at this.
Okay, now let me ask the important question. The mathematicians understand very well what you did was very beautiful, but the mathematicians who studied these theories in the 80s understood these kinds of things in the compact case. And then they got very nervous when we generalized the action, the Chern-Simon theory to a complex SL2C, because it's not clear that the path integral has a well-defined meaning for the non-compact complex path integral. Do you have any insight into that question since you're using the complex path integral?
To be fully honest, we worked at the very formal level. And no, we don't have any new insight about how rigorously defining SL2C Chern-Simons path integral. On the other hand, there are works being done, for example, by Witten in recent years, which go in these directions. We are studying them. I don't know all the mathematical subtleties of it.
Okay, thank you.
Question from Marseille.
Go ahead.
Okay. Aldo, first, it was Mozart. And second, the question is the following. The spin-form four-dimensional model with cosmological constant, there were this previous work by Winston Fairbairn and Catherine Moisberger and by Mouchin, of course. Now, the spectacular result there was the finiteness of the transition amplitudes, the theorems. You didn't mention anything about that, unless I missed it. Do you have something, do you expect something similar? Do you have something to say about that?
I didn't mention it because I have no idea if this holds also in this case. They had a real Q parameter. Here, there is no Q parameter that's to my knowledge. And in any case, it would be complex. So I don't know if any of those results translate here. It's possible, but I really don't know.
Okay.
More questions?
I can continue on this question. Would Mushin answer the same thing, or would it be less pessimistic than you?
Mushin is traveling, so I cannot answer. And I think, I don't know what you would say about the specific question of finiteness, honestly.
Okay.
So, yeah.
There was another question there.
Yes. So one thing I'm confused about is it seems that the cosmological constant is appearing twice in this model. First, it appears in the action, which you're using to define the vertex amplitude. But then later on, you say that the cosmological constant is also present in the boundary data. And I'm wondering how this is possible. Are these two different cosmological constants? Can they disagree? I just need some clarification.
No, it's the same cosmological constant. The point is that these holonomies on the boundary actually determine the sign of that cosmological constant. It's consistently determined with the 4D theory also.
If the two of them wouldn't agree, there would be no saddle point. There would be no solutions for the equations. So the equations of motion require that all signs of cosmological constant appearing on every tetrahedron are consistent.
I get it. Otherwise, it's suppressed. Thank you.
I have a question about the 3D geometry. The question is, it's striking that there's no quantum group. Is this correct? Are you getting a curved tetrahedra without ever working with quantum groups?
No, we're working here at the classical level. So I mentioned at the end that the classical level, we get what's called a quasi-Poisson-Lie group. The point is that Poisson-Lie groups are the classical instantiation of a quantum group. So as soon as you quantize this theory, you expect to get a quantum group out of it. And the quasi part speaks to the fact that it's a spherical geometry. For a long time, we didn't know exactly how to treat the spherical case. But this quasi aspect actually is what takes care of it. It's got to do with the Jacobi identity becoming more complicated. So quantum groups will come out of this at the 3D level. But what we're seeing is that they arise from the Schoen-Simons theory kind of going down to the 3D level.
And this would be a quantum group SU2Q with your complex Q or not?
It would be SU2Q. I think that it actually, as we said, that near the vertex, the SLTC group elements become just SU2 group elements. So the Q would actually get resolved into either a root of unity or a real Q exactly in correspondence with this cosmological constant.
Okay, thank you.
More questions? Okay, let's thank the speakers again.